I'd like to start off here with a guided meditation on the meditation practice, which is the complement or the partner to mindfulness meditation, and that is loving kindness meditation. Mostly here we do mindfulness meditation, learning to pay attention carefully to what happens in the moment, without necessarily hoping or wishing or expecting anything special to happen, just simply to wake up to what's actually happening in the present. Loving kindness practice is the practice of evoking or touching into the intention for well-being, for happiness. So for our own happiness, for the happiness and well-being of some other people, friends, relatives, even our enemies, when the practice gets quite mature, we include them. And it's an intention practice. The idea is to find within oneself whatever even rudimentary wish or intention or motivation for the well-being of one of these people, and then to give words to that intention, to speak it very silently to oneself. And usually it's done by saying very simple phrases, usually four phrases that are repeated over and over again. And some people have called this Buddhist prayer, though we're not praying to something necessarily. It's mostly a way of giving expression to our intention. And our intention in Buddhism is considered to be very powerful. And its power ripples out in many different unseen ways. And it doesn't mean that you have to feel loving kindness. It doesn't mean you have to feel good or wonderful or loving. Those feelings might come with the practice, but rather the practice is to is really to strengthen that intention of loving kindness within each of us. And what some people will find is when they speak or they get close to that wish or that intention of loving kindness, so it kind of works like a tenderizer of the heart. And a tenderizer of the heart sometimes reveals what's kind of buried under the crusts of the heart. And sometimes it's not love or compassion or joy. Sometimes it can be anger or grief or sadness. And the loving kindness practice doesn't require that you feel loving. It requires that the heart gets tenderized and what's there has a chance to come to the surface. So you don't have to think that you're doing the practice wrong because some other feelings get evoked than what you might first associate with it. It's really, as I keep saying, it's really a practice of intention. We find that intention of goodwill, and then we speak it very silently, give expression to it, both silently and in our hearts, and also silently in our minds, with a whisper of a mental phrase. The classic phrases are something like this: may I be happy, may I be safe, may I be healthy, and may I be at peace, something like that. Some people will make up their own phrases so it feels more meaningful for them, for themselves. What we'll do today, this evening, is I will guide you. I will say them out loud, some of these phrases, and direct you in different ways of doing this practice. And then you can repeat silently inside of yourself those words, trying to kind of sink into the meaning or the intention that you might have connected to those words. It's a very beautiful practice. It's a very one that's greatly appreciated in Buddhism. Some people don't like it, especially when they first hear about it, because it can seem like it's artificial. It's like it's like sentimental, or trying to evoke feelings of loving kindness or something. And I was one of those people who, when my teachers first did guided meditation on loving kindness, I would tune them out because I wasn't interested in such things. And then, what's really nice about mindfulness practice is that mindfulness itself is a tenderizer of the heart. And soon enough, feelings of goodwill or love or tenderness will naturally kind of appear or bubble up. And then when these feelings of loving kindness arose out of the mindfulness practice itself, then when the teachers did the guided loving kindness meditation for me, then it made a lot of sense. I had this very powerful reference. And I came to love the practice a lot, and I think it's a wonderful practice. Some people make the loving kindness practice the primary Buddhist practice. They do it for weeks or months or years. I've been told that there are monks in Thailand who have spent 40, 50 years doing primarily this loving kindness practice, and they're somehow, you get into their field, whatever that is, the field, there's this palpable sense of goodwill and loving kindness, which just, you know, it's present. So if you've never done this before, maybe give it just a little enough benefit of the doubt to be willing to follow along. However, if you're stubborn like I was, you could always tune me out and just do your mindfulness practice as you wish. So begin by taking a comfortable, upright posture. Generally, when people do the mindfulness practice, they're encouraged to do the comfortable spot, comfortable part of the posture. And then gently close your eyes. And then take a few long, deep, slow breaths as a way of connecting to yourself, to your body. And as you breathe out, let go, relax your thoughts and concerns. And we'll take a few moments just to be with the breath, breathing normally, not. But see if you can feel your breath as low as possible in your body. You don't have to strain, but just however low in your body you can feel the breathing, the sensations of breath, so that the lowness of those sensations in your stomach or however low you might feel it, helps you to settle, pulls you inward and down to a stable base supporting you. As you inhale, perhaps you can feel yourself expanding upward from that low point. And as you exhale, you get pulled, all of you gets pulled down into the lowness, low center of gravity. And then now bring your attention to the center of your chest, center of your heart, heart area. And imagine now that your breathing flows in and out through that heart area, through that part of your chest. And take a few moments just to breathe in and out of that area, getting familiar with this sense, or this maybe even imagined sense of the breath going in and out through that area. And the love and kindness practice can work a little bit easier if you can find some feeling of tenderness inside of yourself, towards yourself. Tender feelings. Perhaps a modicum of kindness towards yourself. Kind thoughts, kind feelings, kind regard. The Buddha was quite insistent that each person was as deserving of their own love as anyone else in the world. And as loving kindness practice is a softening of the heart, it's traditional to begin with a forgiveness practice. And forgiveness means that we're willing to let that tenderness of heart, that openness and vulnerability, our goodwill, be open. And not closed by resentment or anger. So the forgiveness is done by repeating some very simple phrases, seeing if you can sink into the meaning of the phrases. And you can repeat after me silently. For whatever harm I have caused others, intentionally or unintentionally, may they forgive me. For whatever harm others have caused me, intentionally or unintentionally, may I forgive them. For whatever harm I have caused myself to myself, may I forgive myself. And breathing in and out of the heart center. Seeing if you can find within you some wish for your own well-being, for your own happiness, safety, health, even if it's just a hint of a sense of goodwill towards yourself. And then as you repeat these phrases, see if you can let the phrases be an expression of that wish. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at peace. And in doing loving kindness practice, if it's helpful for you to visualize yourself, or to get some sense of yourself as a whole person or some aspect of yourself, where you're more likely to have a kind regard for yourself, feeling your preciousness, you can visualize or reflect in ways that are helpful. Perhaps you can remember a time in your life when you were quite happy or safe. Use as a reference to inspire you to have that wish for that again. Not the expectation, not the demand for it, a very open-ended wish. May it be so. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at peace. And perhaps you can visualize or sense that the meaning of the words, the sense of the words, radiates out throughout your body, throughout your torso, your arms, your legs, your head. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at peace. And then the practice is to bring to mind someone in your life who cares for you. Traditionally, it's said to be a benefactor, but someone who cares about your well-being. Family, relative, colleague, benefactor, mentor. And you can visualize the person's face, maybe at a time when the person was happy or joyful, contented. And see if you can find within you wishes for this person's well-being. That you would like this person to be happy. You would like this person to be safe and healthy. Again, not with expectation, not with demand that it be so, but a very open-ended, just a wish radiating outwards as a possibility. And now you say the phrases towards this person. Again, sinking into the meaning, the intention within you. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at peace. And then bring to mind another person who has cared about you in your life, concerned about your welfare. And again, if it works for you, you can visualize their face or their whole being, perhaps at a time when they were happy. Maybe remembering what it felt like to be the recipient of their care. And then you can extend the phrases to them. May you be happy. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be at peace. And then again, now settle back on yourself. Get a sense of yourself, be present for yourself. And again, see if you can find feelings of goodwill towards yourself. Feelings of caring, kind regard. Perhaps the same feelings or the wishes for yourself as these benefactors had for you. And then again, let the words of loving kindness wash through you as you say it to yourself. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at peace. And in considering yourself, you might consider some part of your recent life where it's been very difficult for you. Personal difficulties in some ways. Remembering this part of yourself, perhaps you can extend a feeling of goodwill, of kindness, of tenderness to this part of you. May I be happy. May I be safe. May I be healthy. May I be at peace. And then you can continue sitting quietly, either just sitting quietly and mindfully, or you can continue with the simple phrases, repeating them to yourself, offering loving kindness to yourself, letting each breath, the in-breath and the out-breath, be the blowing in and out of goodwill. as a way of ending this sitting, I thought of reading to you the English translation of the Buddha's discourse on loving kindness. And it's quite traditional to chant this. And this is this short discourse is considered to be the source of the practice of loving kindness in the Buddhist tradition. So the Buddha said, "This is the work of those who are skilled and peaceful, who seek the good. May they be able and upright, straightforward, of gentle speech, and not proud. May they be content and easily supported, unburdened, with their senses calmed. May they be wise, not arrogant, and without desire for the possessions of others. May they do nothing mean, or that the wise would reprove. May all beings be happy. May they live in safety and joy. All living beings, whether weak or strong, tall, stout, average or short, seen or unseen, near or distant, born or to be born, may they all be happy. Let no one deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none by anger or hatred wish harm to another. As a mother watches over her child, willing to risk her own life to protect her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, suffusing the whole world with unobstructed loving kindness. Standing or walking, sitting or lying down, during all one's waking hours, may one remain mindful of this heart and this way of living that is the best in the world. Unattached to speculations, views, and sense desires, with clear vision, such a person will never be reborn in the cycles of suffering." And then in Pali, the Buddhist language of Southeast Asia, very close to the language of the Buddha, "Himaya dhammanu dhamma patipattiya buddham pujemi. Himaya dhammanu dhamma patipattiya dhammam pujemi. Himaya dhammanu dhammam patipattiya sangam pujemi. Sabe sata suki hontu. Sabe sata avera hontu. Sabe sata appajahontu. May all beings be happy. May all beings be filled with joy. May all beings be at ease. May all beings be at peace. May all beings everywhere be happy." I believe that most Westerners have been introduced to Buddhism, Buddhist practice, through books first. And if you survey the various books on Buddhism in English, you wouldn't get the impression, I believe, in many of them, that loving kindness is a very important part of Buddhist practice, or even if it's part of it at all. And it's completely absent in many books. However, if you go to Southeast Asia, you find that the concept of metta, loving kindness, is quite pervasive in the monasteries there and the temples and teachings of the teachers and the practices that the Buddhists do there. And I think it's one of the very central values and pillars and foundations for traditional Buddhism. The word metta, which is we translate into English as loving kindness, is etymologically very closely connected to the word mitta. And mitta means friend. And so it has the notion of being like a friend, friendly. We say loving kindness, kindness. We very seldom use the word love in translating the word. I think probably because the word love is a very confused word in English, in the West. It has so many references. I read once Aldous Huxley said that, it was one of the most overused, petty, ridiculous words in the English language. But in the last analysis, we can't give it up. It's such an important word. It's interesting that the Buddha described the far enemy of certain emotions as that which is obviously kind of destroys the emotion or the feeling or the intention. And so the far enemy of loving kindness was understood to be hate. If you hate someone, it's very hard to have love for them. But the Buddha also categorized certain kinds of intentions or feelings as the near enemy of, and the near enemy of loving kindness is affection. And near enemy is that which is so closely related that you confuse the two. So affection is considered to be the near enemy of loving kindness because sometimes affection gets confused with loving kindness. And perhaps the word affection in English is not a very, it's very difficult to translate the Buddhist words from Buddhist languages into English because English words have many different references for them. And affection in the surface might seem to be a kind of neutral, fine word. But what the Buddha was pointing to is the kind of feeling we have where the feeling of affection or love is not freely given, but where there's some kind of clinging or holding on, some kind of expectation of an exchange, some kind of expectation of something in return. And the feeling of loving kindness is not that kind of love. It's not a love where I'll love you if you love me, but rather is a feeling that you would have for someone where you might not expect anything in return at all. When I first went to practice in Thailand, there was this little incident that probably another day or for most other people maybe would not have made a big impact, but it had a big impact on me. I was practicing in a little monastery, and I was kind of at the edge of the monastery, kind of on this little kuti, this little hut on top of some stilts on top of a marsh, and there was this long, these steps going up to my little hut, and then there was these wooden planks that kind of went out across the top of the marsh so you can walk to dry land. And I was there as a layperson, and a lot of the men there were monks, and every morning they would get up in the morning and go there on their alms rounds, and they'd only eat every day the food that they received in their alms rounds. And since I was a layperson, I didn't go out in the alms rounds with them. I would stay back in my hut and meditate. And one day, one kind of mid-morning, I got up from my, before I had breakfast or anything, I got up from my meditation, and I opened the door of my little hut, And there I saw, kind of maybe 30 feet away, this monk was walking away. His back to me, he's walking away. The only place he could have come to was to me, because those planks only went to me. And I looked down at the porch of my little hut, and there were some fruit and some cookies that I was pretty sure that only he could have left there. And what struck me was not that he left them there in and of itself, there was an act of generosity, but what moved me so much was that he didn't know I was going to open the door. And he had no expectation, or no desire, that I know that he was the one who gave me those gifts. And that anonymity, or the whatever you call it, the secrecy of whatever you call it, that of this act was what moved me so much. There was no exchange, nothing required in return. He didn't even want to be known that he did it. And I think this comes out of this feeling of loving kindness, which wants nothing in return. As the Buddha said, it's the feelings that a mother has when she watches over her only child. The kind of feelings, you know, you have a young baby, and you don't really want anything in return from the baby, just feeling paternal or maternal care that kind of wells up. We have the saying in English, or the bumper sticker in English, right? Practice random acts of kindness. I think the Buddhist version of that is practice secret acts of kindness. It isn't that you have to do everything secretly, but the idea being that to do things with it in exchange is to do it from a different motivation than doing it from the motivation of loving kindness. So the mindfulness practice is mostly a practice of being attentive and training our attention to really notice what's going on in the present moment, notice what goes on inside our own hearts, notice what goes on in the world around us. The loving kindness practice is a practice in a sense of evoking or calling forth something within us which maybe is not present at the moment, but is a potential that can be brought forth. So it becomes more of a regular visitor, more regular presence for who we are. In a sense, in that sense, it kind of goes against the grain of the mindfulness practice. Kindness is one of them. And it speaks to the way we want, the motivations for how we choose to relate to the world around us. Mindfulness doesn't choose, but choice is an important part of life. And with a wise understanding, choosing how we respond to the world, I think is part of any kind of wise living. And one of the choices we have is to meet the situation with loving kindness, with kindness, to have that as a frame of reference, to have that as a option that we think, oh, this is useful. I'll try to meet this here in a kind way. And there are times when the situation doesn't, in normal kind of conventional terms, call on kindness. Maybe what calls on is to, you know, in certain conventional situations, it calls for us to flip the person off. How useful is that? Do that, you know, and what is being conveyed? What is the communication that's going on? Communication is kind of like a game of telephone, where if you say something to someone else, or if you express a feeling to someone else, that will get passed on. When you'll carry that with you in some kind of way to the next person you meet, or maybe further down the line, and then it gets communicated in some way, maybe a certain spin that you are carrying with you, certain energy. If someone curses you, then you kind of feel a bit off, and that little bit offness perhaps carries into your next conversation with someone else or someone later in the day. If someone says something kind to you, that puts a certain spin. So the idea isn't to kind of do something artificial, which the last thing the Buddhists want people to do is to create an artificial sentimental emotion, but rather to see to remind us that we have the option of coming back, rediscovering what is not artificial, maybe rediscovering some innate feelings of goodwill, some desire for well-being, some desire that spin that we put out there in the world maybe has a beneficial spin, as opposed to one which has a spin which just ripples the kind of uncomfortable feelings down through the day for other people. So to come back to feelings of loving kindness, to find that intention. Some years ago, a friend of mine was at the beach, I believe, and I don't know exactly how the story went, but there was a conflict with someone else over a parking slot. I think maybe he was blocking someone in or blocking someone out or accidentally took someone else's parking lot spot where they thought they were there first. And the person got out of the car and was yelling and really upset. And my friend kind of listened to this for a little while, and then he said, you have to be very wise, or very, your timing and your feeling, the way you say this has to be just right, otherwise you could get punched out, I guess. But he said to him, you know, you're having a really hard day today, aren't you? And somehow he spoke to the discomfort, the pain, the suffering of that person, because a person doesn't go around yelling and screaming unless they're suffering themselves. And he was able to kind of touch that, or just mirror that, or reflect that, or speak to that. And the person relaxed, and he said, oh yeah, that's what's going on. And then they had a nice conversation, and I don't know who got the parking spot, but you know, just that little statement kind of turned it all around. Some years ago, I was living up on the Haight in San Francisco, and it was a kind of tough neighborhood. I had friends of mine who were stabbed and shot, and it was kind of a rough neighborhood. And one day, the middle of the day, I was getting in my car in the street, and this car came down, careening down the street, and came to a screeching halt in the middle of the intersection. And this woman tumbled out of the car, and these two big football-sized kind of guys were kind of grabbing at her, and she was running out, and she didn't run away, she just kind of got out of the car, and she didn't seem quite herself. And they jumped out, and they were, you know, definitely wanted to get her and pull her back into the car. And this didn't seem like a good scene, these two big football guys and a woman trying to get away. And so I ran up there, not thinking about, you know, that I'm kind of tall, but I'm far from strong. Anyway, so I got out, I stood there between her and these two big football guys. And it was kind of like he would take two steps forward, I'd take one step back, or, you know. And I said, you know, leave her alone, she's coming with us, or she's ours, or, you know, she's my sister, or something. I forget what he said. And I said, well, tell me what's going on here. I tried to engage him, tried to, you know, I said, this doesn't make any sense. You know, she seems to want to get away, she doesn't want to be with you, and he'd take a step towards me, I'd take a step back, and I don't know where it was going to end, but, you know, he was pretty angry and pretty big. And then this other guy who was on the sidewalk came up, and he said, he kind of then talked to the big guy, and he said, you know, if I was in the same situation as this woman, I would hope that you'd come and do this for me. I hope you'd come and get involved for my sake. I hope that you would, you know, if I was in the same predicament as this woman, I hope you would kind of do the same, kind of help me out. And when this new stranger kind of spoke to the common humanity and the common concern for each other's well-being, that diffused the whole thing. Everybody just relaxed. And then the whole thing kind of, how it actually ended up, I don't quite know. But certainly by the time I left, everything was diffused. So this idea of speaking to our common care for each other, concern for each other, and kind of speaking, seeing each other as, in certain kind of depth, I think is really helpful for evoking our feelings of mutual care for each other. There's two beautiful stories. I hope they're true. They're told as if they're true, but that's all I know. They have to do with the Special Olympics, where children who are handicapped in various ways have these Olympics. They participate in. And there was a foot race. And maybe of a bunch of kids who have Down syndrome, perhaps. At least one of them did. But I think they had Down syndrome, all of them. And so they're, you know, ready, set, go. And they all dashed from the start line. And they're running to the finish line. And then one of them tripped. They all stopped. turned around, went back, helped the person up, then they all held hands and walked to the finish line together. And everybody in the audience stood up and gave him a standing ovation. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. You know, does it always have to be competition? Or can there be other feelings, other ways of relating to each other and to life? That maybe actually, the fact that everyone stood up and gave him a standing ovation speaks that those children did something that perhaps was greater nobility than just simply winning a race. The other story is some child was doing a similar thing, running a race or doing some kind of sports, and won. And crossed the finish line and yelled, "I won! I won!" And the people who knew this child all started burst into tears. And the person got up on the podium to kind of receive their award. And I guess said again something like, "I won." And the people around just kind of burst into tears. And people said, "Well, you know, this is pretty nice that your child here, someone, you know, won this race. But, you know, your reaction seems to be a little bit overboard here." And they said, "Oh, our child is autistic. And this is the first time he's ever spoken." So the feelings that get evoked in these kinds of situations sometimes remind us of something that's very precious about being a human being. The Buddha, kind of to quote him directly, what I said earlier. Well, it comes to he said this. It came from a story. There was a king and queen at the time of the Buddha, and the king wanted to test his queen to see if she, you know, how true her love was for the king. After all, he was the king of the country, right? And so everybody had to kind of look up to the king. So the king asked the queen, "Who do you love the most?" And he thought for sure he knew the answer. And she said, "Oh, myself." And that didn't seem right to him. And he said, "Let's go talk to the Buddha about that." And so they told the story to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, "That's right. It's quite appropriate for her to love herself the most." And the Buddha said, "You can search the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you yourself. And that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserves your love and affection." Now this is, you know, from spiritual teacher who insisted that there was no self. So there's a certain safeguard here against being egocentric. Loving kindness in Buddhism is usually practiced first towards yourself, not because it's supposed to be self-centered, but because it's considered to be appropriate and quite healthy to have a kind regard towards oneself, to have love towards oneself. And that it's said that it's not really possible to love someone else in a healthy way unless you're able to love yourself also first. That self-love is then and self-compassion is a foundation for having the same thing towards others. Because without those things, then the tendency is that our love, our compassion for others, is often mixed up in other needs that we're trying to fill. And so the near enemy, so-called near enemy, comes into play. So now probably, maybe many of you have heard the famous story, but I'll tell it anyway, of the Dalai Lama at a panel or a discussion or something with a bunch of American therapists. And they asked him about getting advice for people who had self-hate. And so there was this back and forth between the translator and the Dalai Lama. For a long time, back and forth, you know. And I couldn't quite get what his question was, you know. So back and forth. And then finally the Dalai Lama got it. And he started crying. And then he said, "You know, The translator said, the Dalai Lama never knew that there was a whole culture where this was epidemic. And so, you know, they don't have a word in Tibetan for self-hate. And that, you know, it's unimaginable. But it was unimaginable to the Dalai Lama that this was a cultural phenomenon, you know, widespread cultural phenomena in the West, was what the therapist was saying. And as a meditation teacher myself, you know, I get to meet many people quite intimately in retreats, for example. It's really astounding the degree to which some kind of self-criticism, low self-esteem, or feeling bad about oneself, or unworthy, is really prevalent in our culture. So the loving-kindness practice is an antidote towards that low self-esteem. Classically, it's an antidote to anger, but here in the West, maybe it has a different service. This is a poem by Galway Kinnell. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on the brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. As St. Francis put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow and told her in words and in touch blessings of earth on the sow, and the sow began remembering all down her thick length from the earthen snout all the way through the fodder and slops of her spiritual curl of the tail, from the hard spininess spiked out from the spine down through the great broken heart to the sheer blue milken dreaminess spurting and shuddering, from the 14 tits into the 14 mouths sucking and blowing beneath them the long, perfect loveliness of sow. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it is necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to retell it in words and in touch, it is lovely until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. You know, today is a solstice, and so it's not the full moon, but it reminds me of the full moon is considered very auspicious, a very, very powerful, important symbol in Buddhism. And one of the amazing things about the full moon that is often unnoticed by us who enjoy it when it appears is that the moon is always full. It's only from our perspective that it looks like it's quarter moon or new moon and all that, but the moon's up there just quite fine, thank you. Full, always full. The clouds come and cover the sun or cover the moon. The sun and the moon are untouched by that, are still there shining bright. And this kind of analogy speaks to the beauty inside of ourselves, that the Buddha nature, the preciousness of who we are, the loving kindness, the compassion that we have within us, the fullness of who we are, some Buddhists would call it the perfection of who we are, is always there. It's always full. And sometimes the clouds cover it. Sometimes it's eclipsed a little bit. And so we only see part of it, maybe only a glimmer of it. Sometimes we don't see it at all. But it's understood to always be there. And the practice of mindfulness, the practice of loving kindness, is not meant to create something anew that's never been there before, but rather to reveal the Buddha nature, which is always there, to reveal the full moon, which is always full. So, loving kindness. If you go on retreats, that we Vipassana retreats, it's quite customary that at least one meditation period a day is devoted towards loving kindness practice. But in fact, many people will do loving kindness practice the whole retreat. And some of the teachers in our tradition teach loving kindness retreats. They can be, I think the longest is probably 10 days long. where you go and you used to go for 10 days with a group of people, you practice loving kindness. Imagine just being in a room, people, kind of powerhouse kind of room, just doing that practice. When people go and do the 6-week or 3-month course in meditation retreat back in Massachusetts at the IMS, the Insight Meditation Society Center, there are a few people every year who will do loving kindness practice for the whole 6 weeks or the whole 3 months. And it's quite powerful. The stories they come back, they talk about, they develop tremendous concentration together with this intentional loving kindness. So it's one of the real beautiful things, I think, of the Buddhist tradition, is loving kindness. It's considered to be kind of foundational virtue in our particular tradition of Buddhism, the Theravadan tradition. In the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism, the foundational value is compassion. Both of them are quite beautiful. Maybe I shouldn't, you know, compare one from the other. But the understanding in the Theravadan tradition is that loving-kindness is the foundation for compassion. That without loving-kindness, compassion really can't arise. So that in stressing the primacy of loving-kindness, it's to create that healthy foundation for the other healthy values and emotions that arise out of that foundation. The other two healthy emotions, there's four healthy emotions that Buddhists will cultivate. Loving-kindness is primary. Compassion, a sympathetic joy, feeling joy in the joy of others. And the last one is equanimity. So those are my thoughts for today. And I wanted to introduce you all to this idea of loving kindness, because next time, I'm not here next week, we'll meet next week. And Terry Craven, who's a very senior long-time practitioner, will come and give a talk. And I'll be here the following week, which I think is January 4th, and that's when we begin the next round of the introductory course. So I wanted to take advantage of the solstice and the last class I'll be here before the intro class to do, at least give you a little introduction to loving kindness. You know, at least you have a sense of what it might be. Do you have any questions you'd like to ask, or any comments? Yes.
I was reminded when you mentioned the way when you have an interaction with somebody that it affects the next one you have, and it kind of is a chain of it. From the story a good friend of mine told me many years ago, her husband came home and he was out of sorts because something that had happened at work, and he said something cross to her. And that upset her. So then she said something cross to the 3-year-old. And the next thing she knew, she looked out the window, and the little 3-year-old was kicking the dog. And suddenly it hit her. She said, "Oh, I know why he's doing that."
Was the idea of Buddha nature, or you know, this natural state of a human being totally loving, you know, loving and compassionate. Was that something that was around before the Buddha in practice?
Yeah, it seems that the Brahma Viharas, it seems like a lot of what we think of today as being Buddhism, or parts of Buddhism, were just part of the spiritual environment at the time of the Buddha. And the Buddha was just, you know, he was part of that environment, he grew up in it, and he just, you know, took elements of it and included them in what he was developing. But a lot of those religions of his time died away, and Buddhism survived. So we think of this as being Buddhist, and it's considered by most by scholars who study this that the loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity—those four—they're called the divine abodes. were probably pre-Buddhist. And you find them in other Indian spiritual traditions besides Buddhism. So, and that's, I kind of like that, because it's good not to be too provincial, think that Buddhism has it all, and or too special, you know. Buddhism is supposed to self-destruct, so the more we can learn, the more we find out this from elsewhere, the less we need Buddhism.
So was there something particular that the Buddha did to maybe put his own spin on that in a way? There is this state you can be in that's really great, and this is the best way to go about it rather than these other ways.
I understand your question. I don't know. I don't know what the Buddha added to these, or how he framed them in a way that was unique to his particular teachings. The Buddha put a lot of emphasis on the importance of our intentions. In the spiritual tradition, some of the spiritual traditions of his time, like the Brahmanical traditions, there was supposed to have been a lot of emphasis on ritual and on certain behaviors in making offerings to the gods or whatever. And the Buddha said that those aren't really what has the greatest spiritual efficacy. That what has greatest spiritual efficacy is somehow working on your own intentions, looking at your intentions and what the relationship you form with the life that you live. And so, since the Buddha put our intentionality at the core of his teaching, the issue of these divine abodes, loving kindness and compassion, become quite important. The way that I don't know, this is not answering your question, but in Burma, where I studied these practices quite a bit, the loving kindness practice was taught there not so much for the just so you'd feel more loving and feel better about yourself or better about others, but it was taught as a way of helping people develop concentration and stability, kind of get them stable and concentrated so that they can then be more effectively do the mindfulness practice. So it was pulled into the service of mindfulness practice. Yes?
How so, in terms of getting person's mind off himself and onto doing some loving kindness for someone else? Would that help the concentration?
Yeah. There's a very if you go do it for a long time, like if you go do a 10-day retreat or a 6-week retreat, and just this is all you're doing, there's actually a very formal, elaborate, structured sequence of doing loving kindness, where you begin by doing it to yourself, then you do it towards what's called a benefactor, then you do it towards a neutral people who you kind of know but don't have any particular feeling with about for or against, and then you do it towards your enemy. And then once you can do your enemy well, then you do something, a practice called breaking down the barriers, where you kind of go back and forth between these four, you hold them all together so that your feelings of care, or loving kindness, become equal. There's no barriers or no between the different categories. You feel the same for everything. And then once you've done that, then you begin doing different categories of beings. All women, all men, all children, all animals. And then you start doing it, all women in the northern direction, all women in the western direction, and then in the nadir and the zenith. And so it's very formal, very kind of, and you're doing the same phrases over and over again. The pronoun changes, you or me or they or something. And you're just kind of repeating it over and over again, not exactly like a mantra, but the simplicity of going back over and over again to the same intention, holding that intention in a very directed way, quiets and calms the mind down. It gets the mind very concentrated, just filled with that intention, nothing else. And having this very structured path that you do it in really helps develop this concentration. And people will enter into very deep levels of meditative absorption doing this. Here in the West, when teachers instruct meditation students to do loving kindness practice, they usually are not doing it for the benefit of concentration, but rather it's because of a lot of people in the West have a lot of personal difficulties. They have a lot of anger or a lot of very self-critical or very self-judgmental, or they have some real trauma that they're kind of very hard to be present for. And sometimes it's very effective, very helpful to do loving kindness practice. It can kind of create a very different context for being with oneself. Sometimes the mindfulness practice sometimes... Am I going on and on? Am I on a tangent? Is it okay? I think I'm going off on a tangent now. Is that okay? maybe the near enemy of mindfulness is self-consciousness, being self-conscious. And if you have a tendency of being self-critical, then the mindfulness practice has a danger of giving you more material to be self-critical about, because you're becoming more aware of yourself and all your what goes on. And so for some people, because of the very strong habit of being self-critical, the mindfulness practice can actually be not so helpful, because they just everything gets pulled into that self-critical. It becomes kind of, the mindfulness can practice kind of become a downer for that person, make it things worse for them rather than better. And so occasionally when that happens, a teacher might instruct the person to do loving kindness practice instead, to kind of break that cycle. And they might do that for quite a long time and really change the context, change the way they see and understand themselves. And then when they develop a new relationship to themselves, then they might be able to begin, then come do the mindfulness practice and see these aspects of themselves and hold it with loving kindness and not use it for more self-conscious criticism. So, did I answer your question? Because you asked about concentration. Please.
Did you say that Tonglen is a form of loving kindness meditation?
It could be that. I think of Tonglen as being more of a compassion practice, because Tonglen is the practice of when you breathe in. It's a Tibetan Buddhist practice where you imagine or visualize that each time you breathe in, you're breathing in all the suffering of the world. And, there's a lot to breathe in. And then as you breathe out compassion. Isn't that usually what you breathe out, is compassion? So I think of it as compassion practice. Yes?
Yeah, I have a question. How do you develop the day-to-day skill of loving kindness? Because how can you prevent it from being an invitation to rejection and misunderstanding? I work for elementary school, so I want to know how do I apply that to everyday life.
How do you express kindness around to other people?
Yes, so that not overstepping to misunderstanding or rejection, being rejected. Just the skill. How do you develop that skill?
You're asking how do you develop street smarts, and it's a very good question, but I'm not sure exactly how simply to answer it. I can answer it with maybe it's a cliche, but maybe you've all heard it, but good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. So you have to be willing to make some mistakes and then learn from your mistakes. So maybe you don't if you can experiment, you experiment with small steps first to make small mistakes and find your way, where. But you said without being rejected.
I don't know. I just feel like sometimes the kids like to be left alone, and you need to respect that space.
Yeah.
So that's sometimes some interpersonal relationship, you just want to show you care, but people think they are intervening or you're prying or something. So, but then how do you practice your loving kindness? Do you just turn away or?
Yeah, the loving kindness doesn't have to be expressed, doesn't have to be acted on. It can be a state of heart, a state of intention that you know is there and actually be quite strong. But then you use your whatever discernment, whatever judgment you have of the situation to try to figure out what is the wisest way of responding. And sometimes, obviously, it's not wise to express it. You know, you might feel that way, but to act in some obvious way of being kind is not what's called for. And so maybe it's enough to just back off. There's sometimes situations where are quite trying, quite difficult for me. The person I'm talking with is a challenge or whatever, or I'm going through some great distress. And sometimes I'm not sure, you know, how I'm supposed to respond and what the wise thing to do is or anything. And or whether it's useful to do a kind gesture or whatever. And sometimes I'll just come back to find that feeling of loving kindness, that wish for goodwill inside of me, and do loving kindness practice. That person will never know that I'm doing it. So it's a kind of private affair. Keep it private. Practice secret acts of kindness. Yes?
Loving kindness would seem to imply that there's some type of kindness which isn't loving.
Maybe it does. The Buddhist word is metta. So it's just the way we've chosen to translate it into English. So I think the word metta has no connotation like that. It means friendliness, basically. It's kind of can you think of any kindness which is
it's kind of a word that's wordier than it needs, or a phrase that's wordier than it needs to be, but I just wonder what the implication is by that embellishment.
I don't know. Maybe it's kind of a hybrid, because kindness doesn't say enough, and love is too complicated of a word. But if you put them together, then they kind of make, you know, the loving kind of strengthens the kindness, so it has a kind of a warm, more heartfelt feeling, and the kindness anchors the love in something which is a little bit less sentimental than what pop songs would want you to have. I'm just guessing. You can probably just guess as well as I could. Yes?
Well, I thought something about the kindness that could be separate from love.
Please.
Which is politically based. You know, if you do some kindness for a person knowing that you're going to get payback, or keeping track.
Oh, that way.
You only do it to someone who can pay back. And believe me, that exists.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, well, the last one, and then we'll sit a few minutes to end.
Every week I sit in the back of the room, and I come every week, and I enjoy coming. And I think I'd enjoy it a lot more if I could find out where everybody gets these really comfortable cushions.
I think they're pretty easily available at East West Books in Mountain View. There used to be some years ago, maybe still the case, the Country Sun sells them. There's a lot of mail order catalogs or internet companies that sell them. If you type in Zafu, Z-A-F-U, you probably get companies that sell them. And then Allison Rousen, who sits with us, she has a little business where it's probably the cheapest way of getting them is through her. And there's even an order form here.
This is actually for tapes.
Oh, this is for tape. Well, you could call.
Books, but you could listed in the phone book and the names.
Yeah. So Allison will, you know, and you know, there's different types. There's the crescent moon and the full moon cushions. And they're great to sit on. So, and when you get yours, if you want some instructions, I'll happy to give you how to sit on them.
Great.
So let's This is from Thomas Merton. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, the depths where neither sin nor desire can reach, the person that each one is in God's eyes. If only they could see themselves as they really are. If only we could see each other that way, there would be no reason for war, for hatred, for cruelty. I suppose the big problem would be that we would fall down and worship each other. May all beings be happy.